Welcome to the Together in the UK podcast.
Today I'm interviewing Adina Maghan, the Chief Executive and one of the three co-founders of the Romanian and East European Hub, based in Brent, London. We're going to be talking about her experience of migration, her insights into the huge change in Romania post-1989, and being a voice for Eastern Europeans. Welcome, Adina. And I wonder, first of all, if you could just give me a description of growing up in Romania.
Sure. Thank you, Teresa, for the invite. And I hope our listeners will enjoy this podcast. And I'm really happy you've asked me this question. I think my childhood and, you know, growing up in communist and post-communist Romania, it was simply a world of contrasts. It was a life at the extremes. There were times where I had to feel like a grown-up when I was 5 or 7, and I had to queue for food, and I had to comprehend as a child that there won't be any heating during the night and that we won't have hot water, and that there's no electricity, although we were living in a fairly big city in Transylvania, central Romania. So I had to accept that and comprehend that and internalize it. And then at the same time, I had to enjoy, you know, all the things that children enjoy, playing outside with my friends. So yes, it was a world of contrasts. And then post-communism, post-1989, because I was almost 13.
Yes,
and the revolution.
Queuing for food sounds really, really hard. But can you tell me, did you have the freedom that children had in those days to wander? Did your parents have to sort of look after your heart, keep you close?
We did have those freedoms, and there was a sense of security, but I think it was false, because everything was so controlled under a dictatorship, as you can imagine. People felt safer. I think having stricter rules creates that sense of security, but at the same time, it takes responsibility from people to kind of manage their behaviors, and, you know, it removes compassion because people stop thinking about the impact of their actions on the others. So in terms of my childhood, I think most of the parents relied on the grandparents to look after the children. Let's not forget the working week was 6 days out of 7, and sometimes even 7 days. So only the Sundays were off for people who were in work and even school. I went to school for 6 days a week sometimes. And everyone was super busy. And because of this, everyone relied on the grandparents that the majority were in rural areas. And so did my parents. And I had some really wonderful summers with my grandparents in the south of Romania. And I think I built a stronger relationship with my grandparents. I had these freedoms where I would, you know, just roam the villages and the orchards and just playing outside a lot. There were no cartoons on the TV. There were TV programs lasted only 30 minutes a day, and we had 3 minutes of cartoons, which wasn't fun. Everyone was waiting for that if they were in a city or in an urban area. But whereas in rural areas, no one cared about what's on TV. So those freedoms, they were really good because I've learned a lot. I took part with my grandmother in particular in all sorts of traditions and customs. And we went to the church and we celebrated all that. And there were a lot of activities involving children, young women. And she always tried to involve me in that. And I'm really grateful because I've learned so much through that. And I, you know, there were friendships I could walk to. Nursery, for example, on my own, because it was a small village. It was a very protective community. So as I said, a childhood of extremes. So that's the safety and the fun part. And yes, I was a happy child during that time.
Thank you. That's so evocative and so much to think about what it means to live under a dictatorship. And also, of course, the times that I share with you when there wasn't so much TV, so much distractions, and we read and things like that. But I want to come on now to what do you remember about 1989 and how the country changed?
I remember pre-1989, I was 10, so almost 2 years before that. The city I'm from, as I said, is called Brasov. It's in central Transylvania. And in November 1987, There was a protest from factory workers that were opposing the government and the working conditions and so on. So after that, the city itself, I think it's too much to call it a city, but the town itself got punished by the government. So we had less heating, less food. So it was really, really hard in the 2 years up to December 1989. As a child, I remember walking on the street with my mom and asking her, what would happen if Ceausescu would die? And then she shushed me and she says, please don't say that. We could get arrested. And, you know, just never say anything like that. But I didn't comprehend, like, why can't I think for myself and ask this question? Because everyone would die eventually. But she explained that security could actually take us away. So I should never, ever say it again. So that was the first interaction with the opposition, with the idea of disobeying the dictatorship and the regime. I remember 1989, there were rumors. Everyone was talking about it, but no one was actually talking about it out loud. So we had to use an old radio to try and listen to Free Europe, which was a Western Romanian language radio channel. I think was broadcasting from Germany, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And because it was based in Western Europe, they were broadcasting some news about movements and protests in Timișoara in Western Romania. And we learned about what's happening there, but not in a lot of detail. No one was saying anything. But at the same time, there was a tension, almost palpable, almost physical in the air. Like everything stopped and there was a lot of tension, everyone waiting for something to burst and happen. So I think at that stage, everyone understood that there's going to be a huge change. It's going to be something happening that's going to change our lives completely. And everyone, in a sense, was getting ready. I remember my mom packing our suitcases in case we had to go to my grandmother in the rural Romania, which was, as I said, much safer away from, you know, where the military stations were. So we were ready to just move. And I remember she blocked the windows with some really thick blankets. And then because we've heard about people being shot and, you know, guns being fired in Timișoara against the protesters. And my father was away. He was working abroad at that time. And it was just me, my mom and my brother. And she tried her best to protect us. And then a few weeks later, I woke up at, I think it was 5, 6 a.m., and there was a huge crowd of people roaming the street, including one the street we lived on, with big signs saying democracy, freedom, and just slogans against Ceausescu and the government. And I felt happy. I've experienced happiness because I always questioned what was around me. And I was like, what's the life outside, what's out there, what's beyond this? The world can't be just what we live now here in this little town or the rural Romania. There must be something more out there. So yes, I've experienced a lot of, like, it was a thrill, it was a joy, but at the same time, I didn't comprehend the dangers of that. And then I've heard later on quite a few young people and students mainly that protested were killed. And after that, there was a lot of sadness. We were watching the news. There was censorship. There was nothing on the news. They were going on about with the same propaganda. Everything is great. The country is doing amazing. So that's when I actually understood what the hegemony of a regime can, you know, can look like. I understood that I should always listen to more people, more voices, because I can get a better picture of reality, really, understanding reality better.
There's so much of interest. I hadn't heard about how a town could be punished like that. And you've brought it so to life, those moments before the revolution. I well remember Ceausescu's downfall. And I think in the West, we were kind of waiting for it. We knew it was going to happen. What year did you come to the UK? And do you remember your first impressions?
Sure. We moved to the UK in 2010, in October. And I was just impressed of how busy it was and noisy. I did come from a town that wasn't small at all in Romania. And I did travel before that, of course, to parts of the world. I think that that was the first impression, but there's a lot. It can be a bit overwhelming.
Busy, overwhelming, exciting.
Oh, absolutely. I always wanted to live in London. And it was a dream come true. So super, super excited about it. I thought my English was pretty strong, but it wasn't as good as I thought it was. I didn't struggle necessarily, but I think speaking English, British English, was something I really enjoyed. And I was just ready to take everything in, I guess. It was super exciting.
That's good. And what was critical in helping you make a life here?
I couldn't have done it if I wouldn't have had my family here, meaning my husband and my son. We all were very clear that we want to move, we want to be here, and we want to make a life here. So I think it helped a lot that we all kind of pulled in the same direction and tried really hard to settle in, I guess, in our own way. So whether we did it through going to work or our son attending school and learning English. And for us, it was that. I know that for some other people, there are other factors. But for me, what was important is to have my family with me and everyone wanting to be here. Because, for example, if our son wouldn't have been happy here, then we would have left, no question asked.
That's very interesting. I can see that if one part of a family wants to migrate and the other doesn't, that is going to create lots of tensions. I know you've got lots of experience in supporting European citizens post-Brexit. Can you tell me something about what led you and others to establish the Romanian and East European Hub?
It's a pleasure to talk about that. Just to say that I worked in projects supporting European citizens and Eastern Europeans in particular before Brexit and throughout the whole referendum process. It just happened that I worked for a local authority at that time and we were developing a project engaging Eastern Europeans and supporting them. And it was a bit of pioneering. So I was really, really proud of that project. And that was 2016. And then the referendum took place while I was still working in that role. So it was really interesting to see a change of attitudes to, again, it was the second time in my life when the society changed almost overnight. And all of a sudden I became so aware of my accent and people telling me to go back to my country. Which was fine. I was here to stay. I wasn't going to move just because people told me that. And it happened this weekend, actually, in Reading, when someone heard me speaking Romanian and they told me to go back to my country.
Sorry.
It's still happening, but I've built resilience. So in terms of helping Eastern European nationals and European citizens, it's because I had that knowledge and I was, in a sense, already doing work to support European nationals and Eastern Europeans on citizenship issues like learning about their rights and living in a more cohesive society and develop that sense of belonging and acknowledging their contribution and so on. So literally building a more positive outlook on changing attitudes and influencing them through raising awareness of their presence and their contribution to the society overall. I think I felt a sense of responsibility and I felt that I could really make a change and help people be more compassionate and understand that we are all literally the same. We are all facing the same issues. We all want the same things, like great education for our children. We want to experience good health, have work stability and, live in peace. And then Brexit happened. It was very intense. There were a lot of discussions and I was really blessed to be in a good position to voice the concerns of Eastern Europeans and to be observant of what was happening in my community and other European communities around me. And through work, because I was already working in a policy environment, I could express those concerns and, sometimes make sure they're embedded in the work done to support European nationals in the process. At the beginning of 2020, I was studying at Birkbeck on community development and public policy because these were literally new topics for me. So I only had work experience. I thought I need the theoretical backup to make sure that I'm doing the right thing and I'm really good at what I do and just really to consolidate my knowledge and give me that extra confidence. There was this role advertised, part-time role, at the CVS organization in Northwest London, where I also live, about setting up a Romanian language project and a project to support the wider Eastern European community. So I applied for that role and started from scratch through writing grant applications, developing a service, recruiting volunteers, shaping, you know, the policies and the systems and all that. And then the pandemic hit 3 days later. So we set up a befriending service. However, this was the capacity built the Eastern European and Romanian committee locally. So 2 years down the line, alongside two of the people that were recruited to start the service, we've decided to take it further and turn this into an independent charity with its own projects and its own voice. And that was the initial purpose anyway, to capacity build it and make sure it's brought to this level when it can be sustainable and independent. So we're almost in the third year of the hub and the project and the first year of the charity as an independent organization with 10 paid staff and a board of 6 wonderful trustees, quite great reputation, working in partnership with reputable funders and partners, and a lot of work, thousands of hours behind this project that have brought it to where it is today.
It sounds so important and groundbreaking. You've already described the awful prejudice that you encounter. What would you say are the major issues that face Eastern Europeans in London?
I think they're not seen, and I'll explain what it means. Eastern Europeans are, in terms of data collection and how they are accounted for in our, you know, in the UK systems. So they're white, but they're not. They are BAME, but they're not. They're minoritized, but they're not. And I think there's a lot of stereotyping resulting from that. Is their needs are not heard. So it's a systemic challenge. It's the way they are perceived and accounted for, literally. If we don't know where they are, we can't acknowledge their presence, we can't acknowledge their contributions, and we can't acknowledge their needs. A lot of prejudice and stereotyping is around being benefit scroungers, which is not correct. There's research papers and data to confirm that over 90% of Eastern Europeans and Romanians in the UK are in work, paying tax and contributing to the economy. I think the issue coming from the community is that they already have a broken relationship with the state. Having that past, that history of dictatorship makes you not trust the authorities. When they move here to the UK, it's a completely different system, a completely different approach to the relationship with the citizen. They fear that. They don't know how to take it. They don't know if they can trust it. So that's an issue that kind of is from within the community. I think these are two of the root causes for the majority of the other issues we see emerging in the media, or we hear around us, or we hear Eastern Europeans complaining about.
That's right. Somebody working in diversity, I can see that, you know, when there's a lot of diversity monitoring, there's no kind of separation about saying Eastern European. And so I completely get that people aren't seen. And also that's a really, really interesting point about how relationship with authority is very different if you've grown up in a dictatorship to what you might expect in a liberal democracy. There's a lot to be done. Can you describe your advocacy and what does it take?
It takes a lot of learning and unlearning. I think being from the same background, it helps because I have that lived experience. I share that with the communities I'm supporting. And I think I have to be really open to learn what, you know, where, for example, you identify an advocacy issue, you have to understand what the issue is and why people think in that way. And then trying to unpack that and break it into smaller pieces and understand the dynamics behind it. It takes a lot of learning and unlearning. So I'm trying to unlearn the behaviors or the thinking of, you know, where I could think my peers, Eastern Europeans in the UK, first generation migrants. Why do they make certain choices? But at the same time, I try to understand the system here, the mentalities here, the attitudes, the policies and all that. And also, it's learning because I come from a country where these principles and even mechanisms like, you know, the policies, the policy system and the law, they didn't exist. They didn't exist until 3, 5, 6, maybe 7 years ago. There are jobs here that have a name that can't be translated because they don't exist in Eastern Europe. So that's what advocacy takes, a lot of research and learning and thinking about why certain things don't work. Are they actual issues that you can address, or are they just a matter of how people understand, or maybe they misunderstand? It's a lot of mistrust and you need to address and myth busting. Sometimes you have to also triage, you know, the issues you're trying to address through the advocacy work. Make sure that they are indeed an issue of advocacy and that it's worth investing your resources into that and pursue that. Or it's also a step back saying, can I actually be an advocate for or against an issue on my own? Or do I need to join forces with others? So I think it takes a lot of wisdom as well, but learning and being able to unlearn things that are not useful or that could actually hinder your efforts. And that means you also have to be very honest with yourself. Can you actually do it? If you can't do it, just ask for help.
That is such an interesting response, because I was imagining something about getting in front of the people with power. But what you've taught me is the deep, deep thought that goes into it. What support would you say others can give to this community?
Just ask Eastern Europeans who they are. They're not just one homogenous group of people. There's diversity within that group. There's so much diversity. People have so much in common, regardless of their background. I think if they focus on that commonality, it's what helps. But also, as I said, just be curious. Just ask them, you know, why are you doing this? Why do you want to do this? What's your preference? Can I help you explain something even? Just offer a hand, be empathetic. That's all. I think the community itself is quite resilient and it will get through with some challenges because they've been through a lot. Yes. We have to remember they have a completely different experience compared to the natives here, for example. But they also have a lot in common with other nationalities and ethnic groups that have experienced dictatorship somewhere else in the world. Don't just believe the media. Take one person at a time and one step at a time. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I'm sure. The work can be quite exhausting and requires, it seems to me, an awful lot of depth, energy. What sustains you in this? Is it the cause? Is it what do you find sustains you through all this?
I always perceive this as a sense of duty to help my community and others. I also enjoy the learnings in the job, the fact that I have exposure to debates and forums and research papers and exercises, whether they are from the academic world or the policy work or the practical grassroots work as well. I think it's this sense of duty that I really have to help people around me and try and make this world a better place. At the same time, it's the people around me. I have a great team at the hub, my two other colleagues that helped set up this hub and take it further and bring it to the success it is today. And also everyone in the team is a first generation migrant from Eastern Europe. So we are equity led, and that really makes a difference, because although I am also a first generation migrant from Eastern Europe, I learned so much from them. It just proves the point that I've made earlier about diversity within the community. It's all that. It's the novelty of it. It's the pioneering. It's the challenge that comes with it. And I think I found my voice and my vocation by doing this.
That's fabulous. And I'm thinking that we're together in the UK. One of the great rewards is the learning that you get from hearing people's different stories, people's different life experience. So I can share some of that. Well, the fact that it's a success, you've got 10 paid staff, you've got funding. Can you give us one incident of something that you found really rewarding since you started the hub?
I think the most rewarding thing is that I found the right people with principles very much aligned, people that I can trust. And I know for sure that, for example, if I'm not around, they can take this further just as nicely. And the trust we have between each other, the wonderful skills they have, I think that's quite unique. You can address a lot of other things like funding or recruiting staff, but having the right team, it's so important. So I think with Cecilia and Nadia, who are the other two co-founders, I'm really, really blessed. So it's really rewarding to work with such dedicated people and inspirational women, and also first-generation migrants themselves from the same background. And it's important. It's extremely important. That's what sustains the work of the Hub. And it's one of the most rewarding things I have encountered in my work at the Hub.
That's fantastic. So my final question is, what advice do you have for anyone migrating to the UK?
I think do your research. Read a lot. Don't just rely on friends and acquaintances, because they may have had their own experience that may not have been the best. So make sure your decision is informed. And do trust the government. If you don't, just listen to more opinions, not just one source, but make an informed decision. If you can, of course. Migration can have different reasons. But if you can, just do research and make an informed decision.
Thank you so much for being our podcast guest today. For more information about migrating to the UK, go to www.togetherintheuk.co.uk. And Adina, do you want to say one final word?
Just to say thank you for giving me another opportunity to make my voice heard. I'm really grateful for this and everything Together in the UK does.
Thank you. Bye-bye.